The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible, at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to The Grade Cricketer on the Diamantina Podcast Network. Well, I've been saying for a while now that this is the worst time of year. You won't feel as bad as what you do right now. Everyone's back to work. You've been drinking alcohol for months on end. It seems like just turkey and ham for days and days and days and days. And then the cricket's on and you think, how good's the cricket?
How good?
But then what happens is it rains all the time, and then when it doesn't, we don't play. And then India win the series 2 cricket matches to 1 cricket match. So congratulations to India. No one in India listens to this podcast. There's so much to talk about. Moses Enriquez is on the show to talk about many things.
Enriquez, sorry.
Well, okay, my bad.
Babu Shane Enriquez.
Why can't we just have guys on the team called Dean Jones?
Just he doesn't reply to our DMs.
That's true. Okay, well, this is a wild introduction to start with. Many things to talk about. There's obviously so much cricket happening around the world, least of all in Australia. Enriquez is on the show, and also we're going to have a journalist of some description who we're trying to sort out as we speak. But you already know who that is because it's in the title of the show. My name's Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. Boys, happy new year again. I just forgot that we did a show last week. So many shows happening at the same time. Anyway, welcome.
Too many. Is diluting the product of anything.
It's a very kind of like meandering time of year, isn't it? Not knowing what day it is, etc. I apologise for the cold that I've got as well due to overconsumption of alcohol and my body breaking down entirely. But here we are sitting here, India having won the series 2 test matches to 1 test match. I certainly thought that it'd be closer than it was. I mean, 2-1 is close numerically, isn't it? But the margin was far greater than that. And it is history for India. Some numbers here, like the first tour from an Asian team to Australia happened in 1947. There have been 98 tests played in Australia by teams from Asia. They've only won 11 of those matches, the Asian teams in entirety. 31 tours by Asian teams. 29 captains have tried to win a test or win a series. And 72 years later, Virat Kohli is the first to do it in that Indian team. Like, it is quite significant history. Not if you read the kind of Daily Telegraph or whatnot, or say, yeah, but Smith and Warner weren't there.
Well, I think the big takeaway is how scared the Indian batsmen were of the Australian bowlers.
Scaredy bats. I mean, we all said that, didn't we? And then Pujara came out and hit like 500-odd runs at 70-odd.
He's still batting.
3 centuries and he's still batting. I mean, we've been cuckolded in our own homes, haven't we? I mean, India, we invited India into our home. Yeah. They came here on Australian soil. We're used to, you know, dominating people and teams and people in our own country. And well, it wasn't a very good outcome, was it? Is this something that we had to go through to grow, or does it just suck?
Well, I think we sort of spoke about this last week, is that what did we really want from this series for the Australian people to get behind the team again and to lose honourably? Because that's kind of what's happened. We've been very gracious in defeat. You know, we had a few laughs along the way. I think what's really happened is, and you can tell by the tone of this
introduction to this.
Yeah, it's somber. And I just think that the life of the wickets in the last 2 test matches have just sapped the fucking life out of us. Because they've been, I mean, I think the word disgrace is overused, but the wickets in the last 2 test matches were disgraceful. I mean, just like there's absolutely nothing in it for a game of cricket in any capacity.
I mean, what is going on with Australian wickets? Whenever we go anywhere else, like other countries seem to have an amazing opportunity and capacity to like create the wickets that they need to win cricket matches. Why can we not do this? Should we have a curator on to discuss the vagaries of pitch technology or something? Is this a climate change issue? Why are those 2 wickets in particular? And the SCG shouldn't get off lightly here. The SCG is copping a lot of shit. The SCG's sucked for a long time. Why? And you know, the Big Bash League, the wickets there are quite dead and lifeless as well. 2 words meaning the same thing. said for extra
dead
effect.
And without life.
But
yes.
I mean, what's going on?
I don't know why they're so unusual this year. And I thought you could just make wickets do what you wanted them to do. I don't know the vagaries of pitches and agriculture and so on. But I mean, why were we afraid to doctor them? Like, and what's wrong with doctoring them a little bit for personal gain?
It's a great point, Eddos. And I think that it's got to the point where like people on the internet, the experts out there, they're the ones saying
Maka 69, 69.
He's been saying like, well, you know, beginning of the series, everyone was saying, oh, this is the greatest, you know, greatest bowling attack in the world. Well, fuck, we can't get the Indian batsmen out. That's how shit the wickets are, because this bowling attack, I think, have underperformed, to be fair.
Yes.
But they're still bloody good. And they, like, there's times they haven't even looked like getting a wicket in terms of just there's no bounce, there's no pace in it, there's no sideways movement. It's not swinging. Well, that's probably a different issue. But but like,
that's Warner not being in the side.
But, I mean, there's like, I've been trying to figure out a little bit of like, why numbers are down. And it's probably, it's, you know, as ever with these things, it's never just one thing. It's probably the fact it's not an Ashes year. Last year was an Ashes year, so therefore people often, like, it's expensive. Right. It is expensive going to the cricket. But then it's also like, I think the stock in the team is so low that people are like, people have lost interest in cricket a little bit because they see that, like, you know, it's a falling, it's a falling stock, the Australian cricket team. And but then also just like, why would you go and watch the cricket that's happened in the last two Test matches? Like, literally, what's in it for you? There's nothing fun about it.
Well, I mean, the Australian public is the ones that are being punished for the misdemeanors of Smith and Warner, et cetera. I mean, we didn't fucking do it.
Yeah.
We didn't do it. But the product now has suffered as a result. And, you know, however you want to spin it, cricket is a product. And it's just been a terrible television product.
Couldn't agree
this
more.
This summer, hasn't it? It's just not been more. A good product.
Yeah, totally. But then, I mean, to go back to Pez's point, around the country, the wickets are just fucking terrible.
To back to Pez's point.
Yeah. I mean, like, the average score in the BBL is like in like 130, 140. I mean, teams just can't get it off the square, you know. There's no pace in it. But, like, is that because all the grounds now are football grounds? Is that what's happened?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we're devolving, like everybody else, into just an absolute, like, ocean of negativity. Like, you cannot open any social media page or any kind of traditional media page and not just kind of be bombarded with, like, many and varied things that are wrong with Australian cricket at the moment. Like, this really is the nadir, isn't it? I kept coming back to the idea of, like, well, how much of this is just in relation to how good we used to be? Is it just a cycles thing? You know, are we just meant to go through a bad period like everyone else in sport goes through? I mean, I'm sure many people who listen to the show do like other sports and support other teams as well. There are times when your team just isn't that good, but because we're entitled millennials whose introduction to cricket literally coincided with Shane Warne starting to play, for many people who listen, that's the case. We just have never experienced something like this before and are struggling to deal with it.
I mean, we are struggling to compute this, and it seems that we're capable of hitting some runs. I mean, there were a lot of 30s.
Yes.
But there's a big difference between 30 and then batting big like Pujara did. I mean, this almost screams like it's an existential problem. You mentioned millennials, short attention spans, consumable bite-sized pieces of content that are no longer than 3 minutes in length, like many of our videos on social for Wagner, a sponsor of a different product that we perform for Channel 7. Is it a problem with – is it society?
Yes.
Can we put all this on society?
I think when you, like, aggregate everything wrong with cricket, you know, Smith and Warner cheating or whatnot, BBL wickets sucking, et cetera, like, I think you can actually draw an inference that, our innings are actually just reflecting media as it is today, small, bite-sized and flashy.
Snackable, sponsorable content.
Snackable innings is what we've got.
That's why Chris Lynn's the best player in Australia. Because, like, that's what he runs. He hits a six, though.
We are now – Australia are now the owner of, like, so many – We piled up unwanted records this summer, like especially in the last few days during the rain delays, and we'll talk about broadcast wars during rain delays shortly, but like it was just a sea of like unwanted records just continually being spat out. Forget the SCG one of there being 25 days lost relative to the MCG of 9 days lost, like one century in 10 tests from the Australian side. This is the Australian cricket side. You know, we are used to like – we should be producing six batsmen who are gluttons for runs. I don't want to get back on this gluttony train again, but we're just snacking now on innings.
We're snacking and we're filling up real quick.
Exactly.
And we're watching our diet for some reason because we want washboard abs. Well, we should just be fucking gluttonous.
Exactly.
We need for runs and just...
Yeah. Nobody averaged over 40 this year in the Australian cricket side, this including Smith and Warner, who played the early season.
Yeah.
But we're nobody averaged over 40.
No, we're your eyes just bulged then.
Yeah.
Frighteningly, so it looked like you had Lyme's disease.
Well, the thing is, like, okay, it's okay to sort of, or maybe I do, but, it, you know, that may well be the case, Dave, but.
It's not recognised by
over
science.
Over a period of 12 months, you then are exposed to a multitude of conditions, which means you can't sit back on the idea of like, oh, well, this wicket was green or we lost the toss here or these guys weren't playing here. It's 12 months. You play all over the world. You win some tosses, you lose some tosses, and we still can't get a guy to hit a ton or average over 40, with the exception of Usman Khawaja's wonderful innings, which will sustain him for the rest of his life, in my view.
Mm. Well, we're not used to looking at terrible stats, are we? We're used to just foraging through numbers and looking at records that indicate that we are the best in the
wonderful
world ever.
Numbers. I went on a YouTube rabbit hole the other day. I forget how I got into it, but it got it like I think it was a Cricket Australia. Yeah, I really do forget how I got into it, but it was all right stuff, let's be honest. But it was a CATV one about Shoaib Akhtar performing at the Wacker, and he sort of took 5 for 60 or something.
He was bowling to Ponting, and it was quick.
It was probably initially a Rob Belinda video that then CA took down, and we want to get him on the show for an internet special down the track. But that's a separate topic. And I looked at the game and I was like, I just saw the scores as Akhtar was taking his wickets, and it was like 4 for 70 at one point. This is in 2004, and I was like, oh, he's going through them here and all these great players, and then it was like 5 for 316 or something. So then I started going like, oh, what happened in this match? So I got a quick info and I'm like, I got on him. No, I did, and I looked at the scorecard and like Australia were 4 for 70, and then it was just like Langer hit 193 and Gilchrist hit 100. Pakistan didn't do much with the bat, and Shane Warne took like 5 for the next innings, and then in the final innings, Glenn McGrath took 8 for 24 of 16. And I was like, okay.
See, I wonder if like the great team that we had and we grew up with have just completely ruined us in many capacities. Because like, I mean, I think like all sporting teams are cyclical, right? I mean, like, we were shit. We, being the Australian cricket team, were shit in the 80s.
Yes.
And then the 90s came along, then we started to get really good. And then we were amazing for probably like 15 years. Yeah. We were just incredible.
Yeah, and impregnable.
And then we were shit in 2000. And when did England come here and win the Ashes? 2011?
10-11.
10-11. Yeah. We were shit then. And England in that point have been shit for decades.
Yeah.
But then they had a great team for like probably 3-4 years. Yeah. And then they're shit again.
Yeah.
And then now they're getting quite good.
Yeah.
So in that time, like this like this blip we've had, we were amazing. Then we were shit. Then we got really good again, won the World Cup.
Yeah.
We won the Ashes 5-0, then 4-0 here as well. Yeah. And now we're like shit again. So we're kind of like Man United, you know, in like the same time. We're like 20 years, just amazing. But like in reality.
But is there any national teams that have been, like maybe the All Blacks, but they've had kind of peaks and troughs here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, in terms of sustained awesomeness over decades and decades.
Yeah. Like, do you remember going out to the SCG or whatnot, or growing up and like your old man or maybe your grandfather? And I'd specifically reference men because when we were growing up, women were also ultimately excluded from cricket. But like, they would tell you stories of how good maybe Doug Walters was or Bradman or whatever. Like, do you know how insufferable we're going to be as grandparents? Just going like talking about eras to our grandchildren that happened well before they were born, going like, no one was better than Warne. No, it doesn't matter. Like, there'll be people on the stage who probably, like, someone might rival Bradman's average or something, and we'll just be like, nah, it's got nothing on Mark.
Even the weed, Mark Wall. 41.13.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
the way he clipped them off those legs.
I know for a fact that I'll be talking about Manus Labuschagne's 38 at the SCG one fine summer's afternoon in January at the SCG.
Where were you when they incongruously picked a guy with a shield average of 28 to bat number 3 for Australia?
And bowled leggies.
And redefined the number 3 batsman as social construct.
No, hang on. He batted 3 for Australia and bowled leggies, which is the ultimate dream. Of all
so
children.
Was he the best player ever?
He must have been.
That was just a historical anomaly.
Exactly. Should we talk about the selections of picking Labuschagne? I mean, I thought, geez, didn't he bowl well? For a start,
I thought he spun a couple.
As a leggy who grew up and got the yips at age 16 or 17, like my head was in my hands. I was just watching some of them come out. And I was like, oh, it's happening again.
His first over, for those who didn't see, bounced halfway down the wicket three times. The balls 1, 3, and 6 literally bounced at his feet. And so when you're picking a guy on, it reminded me of quite a lot of like when England's come to like the SCG and they've already lost a series 3 or 4 nil, and they just pick a random leg spinner who's played
just ruin his career,
and just ruin his career. Yeah, Ed Cowan said on our live stage for the Sydney show, just like it's not his fault they picked him, which is true. But geez, they're doing their best to just ruin him. Just pick a guy at 3 in a really tough series, trying to save the series for Australia. Oh, and also just bowls like 20 overs of leg spin as well when he doesn't really do that. Yeah.
Here's a chance. Take it, and we're geniuses for selecting you. Yeah. Fuck off. We'll just pick another person who's kind of like you in your place. It's a tough one for him. And similar things were kind of done with Finch, I guess, the way he was kind of told to open the batting in a position where he didn't even perform at its shield level.
Yeah.
What's going on with the selection?
Well, just the bizarre setters of the selection is just like, I mean, there's probably like eight guys batting around Australia who have higher shield averages who just aren't in the frame. Mm. Like, I don't know what Joe Burns has done, because like, we're literally crying out for an opening batsman to score some runs in the series. Mm. Joe Burns is like, I think he has the third or fourth highest average.
He scored some runs this year. I don't think he's hit a shield 100 this year though, has he?
Who has though?
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, Matt apparently Wade that's has, the metric. Like, it's interesting though, like, you know, at the risk of being overly contrarian and people throwing their fucking phones against the wall saying this, like, when the first test side was selected, like, I don't think there was too much consternation over the side itself, like, apart from maybe Sean Marsh is still getting a go, let's get into the Marshes a little bit. Mm. And like,
sorry to derail you, but I think like, to go against that, I think we were asking like why Finch was opening the batting when Cameron
I think
White...
people are okay. So sorry, I should be more specific. I didn't. The players that were in the side weren't. There wasn't too much conjecture about it, right? Because I think most people understood that while these other guys like who had performed the metric of actually scoring runs, both recently and like historically, like Burns and Renshaw and Maxwell and who's the other one we're just talking about? Wade. Each of them had like a decent-ish shot at test level, and to be fair to them, had not looked like they necessarily belonged. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get in the head of the selectors who are getting absolutely panned at the moment, and I'm definitely not defending them. But surely that must be what they're thinking when it comes to not selecting these guys again. They must look at them at the test level and go like, yeah, okay, you can be quite good at first class level, but we don't think you're the guy to make the jump, so we're going to try some other guys. So they've tried the other guys. Mm-hmm. They failed too, which is why everyone's coming back now going, okay, well, you just have to select the guys who score the most runs in shield.
I am of the notion that you're allowed to get better as a player. And so, for instance, like
that's a controversial notion.
That is. For instance, like, I mean, just to go back to Ed played test cricket, played 18 tests for Australia, and then he went and played shield cricket and he became a far better player, almost scored 1,000 runs in a shield season that we keep crying out for. Mm. And then the next season, New South Wales are like, nah, you're too old, mate, even though he's the same age as Sean Marsh and could have played probably for another 3 or 4 years of test cricket. Anyway, the point being is that, like, I think you need to be allowed to play test cricket, realise the step up you need to make, go back to shield cricket, make your runs, and then be a better player. And that doesn't seem like a logic, because it seems like you are tainted once you fail. You know, Pete Neville's a guy as well who's a shield run getter, averages 40s in shield cricket. But
I think there's no coincidence that the decline of Australian cricket coincides with the decision to rebrand grade cricket as Premier cricket.
Yeah, well, totally. That's right. That's where
just a rebrand. Just a rebrand.
It's a rebranding.
Yeah. But I mean, and that's your point there, Hugo, is what concerns me as well. So when I explain that Devil's position, that's not my position at all. But I think maybe the guys that have failed here are also – maybe they're going to get the shot. Maybe they're going to be allowed to fail and continue. But when we watch them at the moment, we're thinking, I don't know if half these guys are going to be the guys to do the job for us. Mm-hmm. So in the absence of guys who are actually performing at test level, you have to go back to that metric of who's actually scoring runs the level below. Mm. But the catch-22 problem they have there is that the shield competition's been degraded so much, both in terms of its schedule and who's actually allowed to play. Mm. I mean, people have said it's a glorified under-23s competition. Mm. You know, at the moment, you can't even trust the results there anymore. Mm. So it's just a mess. It's an absolute diabolical mess.
And like the best example of it is Agarwal, who is currently playing because their scheduling is they don't stop to play Big Bash in the middle of the season. Agarwal's just been churning out runs in the Ranji Trophy. Mm. Comes in just full of confidence, full of form. Looks like an absolute world beater. Another one to churn into the runs. Whereas we're really scratching our heads to try and pick a batsman.
Can we just one last thing on the selectors? He goes. Speaking of Cowan, he came. He's made a lot of quite grabby comments on the ABC of late, which is, you know, his job. And he came out recently and said that you know, the headline was something like national selectors have an agenda, to which he wrote back on Twitter, that's a bit of a sensationalist headline. Then when I click on the actual article in quotes, he says that it looks like they've got an agenda. G'day, Ed. But He did make the point that, like, the England selectors model now has changed. They have Ed Smith in charge, who's only relatively recently retired. They have James Taylor, mm-hmm. who had to retire due to health issues, who knows every county player kind of inside out, both in terms of their runs, their statistics, you know, and what they bring to the team, the sort of people they are. He's very close to it, whereas Australia's selectors are, in Cowan's terms, you know, two generations past that. And he sort of said, I think we miss a trick by appointing two people well and truly out of the game.
So he's talking about Trevor Hones and Greg Chappell.
And I mean, just so much of Australian cricket's malaise, both systemically and selectorially, seems to come back to Greg Chappell. Is he... Does he have a force field around him, and he's just
Well, I know that my dad and I know probably your dad's collectively all point to Greg Chappell as being one of the greatest batsmen they ever saw, and is the myth of Greg Chappell just carrying him forthright until his deathbed that he will forever be the doyen of Australian cricket?
I've got this thing, this theory that, like, you can't be an amazing batsman and a great coach. I know, like, Greg Chappell to me, just watching the highlights, you know, the old World Series cricket and stuff, just a naturally gifted batsman, you know. I don't think you can be that naturally gifted and be an amazing coach.
So it's kind of like,
because
you
just go out there and do it.
You know, Mark Waugh's like, oh, why don't you just go and do it? Because I could do it really easily. It's easy.
It's like 30 Rock living in the bubble. You know what I mean? You're just so good looking, you don't realize how hard life is for everybody else. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is hard. And like Mark Waugh, for instance, said, oh, I don't know why you just don't get down to the full to off spinners. Doesn't rate spinners. I heard him talking about the Big Bash the other day, just like all these leg spinners who are, like, clearly cleaning up world, like, you know, T20 cricket around the world. They are the statistically the most successful bowlers.
Mark Waugh said something on Twitter about selections, and he said, you know, why is everyone, you know, there was a kind of a question around communication between the players and the selectors, and people have been saying that, you know, there's a communication breakdown of sorts between selectors and players, and you're not explaining why you've been dropped. And he says, oh, there was nothing to explain. It's normally runs and wickets. But it's not really, is it? Well, it's certainly not runs.
Yeah. I think as well, I mean, Pez, I was talking to you about this, maybe at Azure, just like in terms of, like, when you're in cricket, you're just so ensconced in this bubble and you're like, you know everything about it. But then, like, the longer you spend out of the game, the more you, like, drift out of it. And we've even noticed that in terms of, like, none of us have played in a couple of years now, and just like the jokes you make, they change over time because you disassociate. It's got to be the same with, like, coaching and playing stuff. Like, you can go to Nets and watch Nets, but you've actually got to be participating.
I go and watch, like, a game of grade cricket in order to tweet.
Exactly.
And then, like, I come back with, like, 15 tweets in my draft just from all the observations you've seen.
There was no better example of that, Hugo, than when they got Usman Khawaja onto the T20 I commentary.
Exactly.
Or the one-day commentary. I can't remember which one it was.
T20.
And it was the former generation of Simons and Gilchrist questioning Khawaja, who was quite happy to say that the game has changed, boys. It's not just about putting the front dog down the wicket and hitting through the line of the ball and going at six and over and everyone thinking that you're amazing. You've got to go at 10 and over now, and you've got to do different things to get people out of the way. And I think, you know, if the guys in the generation before are struggling to kind of come to terms with the way the game's played now, imagine how the guys a couple of generations before that are struggling as well. You know, there's this broad sense that, like, Australian cricket batting wise is a little bit behind the countries who are leading the way. They're struggling with the adaptation to three format cricket. You know, their schedule is all over the place in terms of, you know, how to get the most out of red ball cricket, but how to maximise the BBL and get kids into the game. And then the guys who are making the call, you know, there's been a massive administrative clear out. There's a cultural problem. Our two best players are suspended for cheating. Like, it's fucking dystopia. Yeah, right now.
Sci-fi.
Great for us.
Science fiction, absolutely.
Yeah. I saw on Twitter, just to your point, Pez, Gavin Robinson, it was in the beginning of the it was during the Sydney Test match, and then Usman Khawaja played a reverse sweep, went for four off Jadeja, I think it was. And then Gav Robinson on Twitter was saying, oh, there's that reverse sweep early on in the innings. Didn't see Pujara play that shot once. You know, what's wrong with these guys? Getting in behind and stuff. Well, and then someone commented, he literally did it for the entire innings where he scored 150 in the UAE to save a Test match for Australia. It's like, but the weird thing is, like, you know, none of us played reverse sweeps. Like, it is like a thing where everyone plays it within the last probably 5 years. Mm. It's a real new thing. But, like, I mean, I never played it, but I can understand the benefit of it.
That's why there was also equally such a visceral reaction to the way Hanscom bats really far back in his crease, because it goes against everything we were trained as children and young adults to bat out of your crease.
Yeah.
literally out of your crease, and as Coley does, which we all celebrate. Yeah. But we, you know, we find it hard to come to terms with Hanscom's beta approach to stance. Mm.
And isn't that, you know, like with everything else in this society, the entire thing can be understood through the prism of the PC versus anti-PC movement. And basically Australian batting at the moment is PC. It's snackable. It's got new ways of thinking about things. And the old way, which is anti-PC, is the way we want to revert to. And you can just feel it. You can feel the anti-PC just slowly creeping back into Australian cricket. Like, you know, next year or whatever it's going to be, let's go back to being the mongrels that we used to be. Get down the front dog, hit him down the ground, bowl 140s. That's the way we do it.
And that's why Rodney Hogg should be the chairman of selectors.
So a lot of discussion. Sorry, Pez, you want to jump in?
No. I was just going to say, if we are finished with that, like, I wanted to say something about the fact that it rained for a day and a half at the SCG.
Yeah.
Right,
so. Yeah, no, it's all good. So I mean, it's a lot of chat about scheduling and stuff. Mm. And there's a stat going around about there's been 25 days of rain at the SCG compared to the second most, which is 9 for Melbourne. Mm. I think Perth had 0, which we learned. Never rain. They didn't see clouds.
They actually need the rain.
They actually desperately. Mm. That to me says that it just rains a lot in the first week of January in Sydney. So let's move the fucking test matches so we can get a game in. Because I don't need the SCG test match to be a New Year's test match.
No.
It can be any time.
Yeah, it wasn't. And it hasn't historically always been that way. But yeah, I mean, heaps of. Yeah, we could move a whole bunch of stuff. Melbourne doesn't have to be Boxing Day. Although, actually, I think Melbourne needs it to be Boxing Day. Otherwise, it would be more grim than it already is. Yeah. It did give both broadcasters, I thought, a chance to really show their wares in terms of, you know, what they are stylistically. Mm. Fox versus Seven. You know, we're doing this on the Diamantina Media Network. We've got no conflict of interest in this conversation at all. But, you know, when there's a rain delay in broadcast, you get a real chance to see who they are. And, like, I thought it was so telling. I just wanted to go through a comparison of what I saw, because I have a subscription to Fox and I also have Seven as well, naturally. But, like, I don't know if you guys saw it, but there was just this most wonderful interview at lunch between Bruce McAvaney and Tim Lane and Jim Maxwell, friend of the show, Maxwell. And on it, there was such wonderful footage. You know, Tim Lane was talking about his commentary of you know, Shane Warne and Steve Waugh in the West Indies when Shane Warne got dropped and Steve Waugh kind of had a real go at Tim Lane. Right. And they were just discussing kind of broadcasting issues and techniques and stuff. Tim Lane talked about the World Cup, and it made me think, actually, with the World Cup, with that famous run out against South Africa. You know, when Mark Waugh comes across from mid on and picks up the ball and flicks it, is he trying to hit the stumps there and he misses?
Yeah.
Is he on record saying that?
No.
Because what about one of the, like, all-time misses because he's really close to the stumps as well. So, again, Mark Waugh is kissed on the dick. Lucky. Like, I don't know if anyone's picked that up in that sequence of play. Like, it just, even Mark Waugh still makes an error look really good. Looks like a really calm roll of the ball to Fleming. But, like, he's actually missed from about 2 yards there. And if they'd gone for the run and they're like, someone hadn't turned back there, then, you know,
well, it would have cost us the World Cup. I mean, talk a kiss on the dick. Lehman 2 balls before missed from a meter.
That's right.
I mean, you know.
And I guess Fleming dropped one over the rope as well, yeah.
A rifle, I think it was.
Rifle, pardon me.
Yeah, just the golden generation.
Yeah, that's right.
Everything went right. There's this amazing footage of Brett Lee getting pulled by Brian Lara at the boundary at the WACO. This amazing pull shot. Mm. And then, you know, Jim Maxwell's talking about the Indian god Ganesha, you know, the god of beginnings who removed all obstacles. Mm. I think Maxwell's return to broadcasting has been one of the great stories of this summer as well. It returned to his health. Mm. You know, like, Channel 7 had this beautiful package about, like, cricket on French Island in Australia, salt of the earth families, you know, beautiful ground, et cetera. And, you know, like, they use, like, Bjork as the outro tune to their ads. Fox was showing Gus Wallen getting massaged naked in India and asking whether Shane Warne double-dipped a sausage roll.
Oh, mate.
You know, they really both showed their wares. I'm not saying making a comment either way. I'm just merely comparing what both networks were doing.
You're just comparing. You're not making any kind of comments either way there. I saw Alan Border double dip a sausage roll in the media box. Just in front of everyone. Like, I'm the fucking former Australian captain. Yeah. I'm putting this sausage roll twice in this bowl of tomato sauce right in front of me.
I would imagine that the people who listen to this podcast are probably Channel 7 people, because I think if you like cricket, you like conversation about cricket, you like engaging with people like Gideon Hay and Pete Lawler, Jim Maxwell, you want to hear stories about cricket being told, it being presented in different and interesting ways. Mm. Or you're the other side, you're the barbecue land Australia where you're just like, oh, Warnie.
Gus Wallen, I can relate to him because his best friend is Hugh Jackman. Just relatable, isn't it?
Gussie.
How good's a meritocracy?
But then saying that, Channel 7 also filmed stuff with us and then decided not to use it because they wanted to show Cricket to Creek or whatever the show is.
The fishing show with some notional burly Australian man and someone getting a snapper.
That was picked ahead of us. And yes, that is a true story. We did film some stuff with them for broadcast and they go, nah, I wouldn't have thought so, lads.
We only got to fill in 2 days.
Yeah. The test match was too interesting for us to show that. All right, so just quickly, the ODI squad's been announced. There's been a lot of conjecture about that. I personally don't think it really matters because India are fucking amazing. You think Kohli's got a test match cricket? Well, Jesus Christ, he averages about 90 in a one-day cricket. So
could be really bad, couldn't it?
It could be real bad. But then Pujara doesn't play because he's focusing on the red ball stuff, and that's the secret.
Good. Yeah, and we've just got Peter Siddle back.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk about a cricket with a journalist now who actually knows stuff about cricket. Pez, do we know who that is just yet?
Not just yet.
Not just yet. All right, we're going to take a break, and then after that, we're going to be speaking to Moses Enriquez before hashtag AskJDC.
It's our distinct pleasure on The Great Cricketer here to have one of the best presenters in cricket on the other line. It's Mel McLaughlin, who's with Channel 7. Just off air, she told us that it's really weird talking to us because while we're funny on cricket, on Twitter, pardon me, that our voices sound strange. So, Mel, hello and welcome.
Oh, that's a great bedrock and foundation for a great chat. This is going really well so far, but it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Bedrock, that's a new term. See, so you're already showing your...
No, that actually came. I don't know where I pulled that from. I actually thought that at the time. Seconds ago, I thought, where'd you get that from? Wow.
Well, that's
that's like everything that we've ever created in terms of content.
Yeah, exactly.
Why'd I say that?
Come out of my head. I guess the first one, Mel, is, I mean, we're all, as you know, consumers of sport, getting used to some new faces and two rival broadcasters trying to bring us to cricket. You know, how have you found helming the Channel 7 coverage throughout this India series?
Well, to be honest, I've just loved every second of it. I think everyone has. It is, it's funny when you mentioned both broadcasters because pretty much everyone in some capacity is sort of mates with each other or like really good mates or work together or, you know, some of the former players go way back. I obviously know some of them have worked with them and obviously, for example, Neroli, she's a friend from Fox from years back. So that part is probably a bit, maybe in Adelaide when you look over and you see there's two full setups and they're both Aussie and they're both on the same ground and a few metres from each other. It's probably a little bit odd, but I think everyone's just, you know, it is what it is and everyone's just doing their bit and having a great time. It's a very different thing if you haven't worked on Test cricket before because, you know, for me, Big Bash or football or whatever, there's pretty much a start and finish time. This is yesterday was a strange one, sort of waiting around and going, what are we doing? What's going on? So, yeah, it's a different experience, but it's been amazing and I've just loved it. Everyone's loving it. We're having a lot of fun.
So was there never any early tension, you know, in those first few hours when you both turned up, you know, Fox Sports and Channel 7 to do the coverage of the first test? No early kind of sussing each other out in the press box?
Oh, yeah, that's totally our style, you know. I'd love, you know what? I promise I'd tell you if there was, because it'd make a good story. But it's actually just been a big reunion. Just everyone's just been really excited, and big hugs and catch-ups and stuff. So, yeah, damn. Unfortunately, there's been none of that. Sorry.
So Mel, yesterday, obviously, with the... Was it yesterday? Well, when did the cricket finish? I lost all track of time. I don't know what day it is, yeah. There was obviously...
Or day before, if you want to get technical.
No, we never do here. Mm. But the rain delay must be an absolute nightmare for broadcasters because you get no idea when the game's actually going to start again, if it's going to start again. Like, how do you guys deal with that sort of, like... Is it a stressful time to fill in that time?
To be honest, it's... For me, it's fun because it means I'm sitting down and just chatting to people and we're like going through stories or the issues or, you know, that's what I love to do. And you're interviewing people and we have amazing producers. Our producer, her name's Andrea, can't rave about her enough. She's just very creative. So she's in my ear and in everyone's ear and she will just say, I want to go this way. You've got 10 minutes. And that's amazing because you don't ever get that. You get maybe 2 minutes of this, then move on. So we might have... you may have heard of this segment, the Night Watchman, for example. But some of the journos, Pete Lawler and Gideon Haigh, they'll come in. Trent Copeland's alongside us as well. And so we'll just be able to just go and just talk whatever we want, the issues, you know, and then keep an eye on the weather at the same time. Mm. Or someone's keeping an eye on the weather while we're doing it. And then, you know, you just swap around. All the commentators sort of mix and match, and we have different people to chat to. We'll talk Big Bash. We'll talk, you know, Glenn McGrath will come in and talk about how the McGrath Foundation, how, you know, Jane McGrath day went. And from my point of view, it's a lot of fun when you're on air, being able to just, you know, you've got a bit more license to do things. Mm. But when you're out there and you're looking out the window and going, what? And everyone's just broken. Your spirit does get a little bit broken. I think everyone does, because you're going, can we just call it? You're not impressing anyone. Where were we? I think it was 34 in Melbourne. And we had to put up a resistance, and we had to put up a fight. Mm. Our tail combat really well, and God love them for that. But we're all waiting in the race box in Seven Cricket Australia, just waiting for those wickets to fall. They took the extra half hour. Yeah, and it's so close. You know, come on, mate. We should get it. You can bat, but just let it go.
That's cricket, isn't it?
Were packed, and then they were unpacked.
Yeah. I mean,
just hoping that your teammates get out. That's cricket. Yeah. Let's get out of here.
Well, isn't that horrible? Yeah. That's very un-Australian, and I'm really sorry to everyone that just heard what I said, because go Australia, but my God. You know?
No, well, I've said too much. Well, Mel, rule number one here, the great cricketer, is the best thing about cricket is when it's finished.
Yeah, or when other people fail.
When other people fail.
Yeah, I mean, this is possible. Yeah. I mean, you talk about there being a lot to talk about during rain delays, and this is an unfair and indulgent question, but, you know, Emma Davenport recorded something with us at the SCG on day one, and there was a day and a half of rain, and our stuff didn't go to air. So can you give any sort of feedback or indication as to why we didn't get on the broadcast? Did you kibosh that, or was that Jones?
Firstly, yeah. So are you saying you watched every second looking for yourself?
Absolutely.
You said a day and a half.
With my dad and my wife as well, yes. I've sat them down.
I recorded all 5 days. You said I'm going to be on. I swear I'm going to be on any minute. That's what you did, right? Yeah.
That's right.
I'm really sorry. Yeah. I'll call. It's probably, you know, she's the sweetest lady you'll ever come across, but clearly this is her fault, and I'll call her and I'll get to the bottom of it, okay? Because that's not okay either. Sorry. On behalf of Seven, I'm sorry.
As long as someone's head rolls over this, Mel, that, I mean, that's all we ask for.
Done.
Mel, how'd you find working with Akash Chopra? I mean, he was obviously in a very happy mood, you know, because obviously India winning more test matches than Australia won. But were you sort of getting any feedback as well from the Indian fans watching the cricket?
Well, always feedback from the Indian fans. Obviously, they know their cricket better than probably everyone, any expert. It's amazing. It's something that you love as well. But Akash, some of us had met him before, and he just, I can't speak highly enough of him. He's a top man. He's lovely. He's really funny. He's a real character, and he's got really good insight, and he says some things. He can go a bit hard early on, you know, when you're sort of visiting, and then you can just like mic drop and get out of the country sort of thing. So he did a bit of that too, which is, you know, there's a good value in that. But I loved any time I could work with him, because when you're working with someone who, you know, is going to be, I guess, generous, they get it, really switched on, but good fun as well, and a nice balanced approach. He was, of course, he's really, really happy for India, but I think he's quite a balanced guy as well. But, you know, in terms of Indian fans and feedback, I think, well, everyone gets criticised. I'm not talking about him, just in general. There's always, you know, someone that just thinks you're rubbish, which is fine. He might have the odd detractor. Mate, I don't know, I'm guessing, but I think he's brilliant. And I know everyone loves having him. And we're saying, can you just stay for the Sri Lankan test? We know it doesn't make any sense, but can you just do it anyway? It'll be fine. But he's off to... He's back to India, and then he'll come back to, I think, we'll go to New Zealand with the family. So, it was a really great addition, and just a lot of fun to be around a good man.
There's obviously, with this series especially, you know, there's so much talk about the Australian team's behaviour and stuff like that. Were you guys, like, briefed at all about, you know, watching out for how Australia went about, you know, just not even sledging necessarily, but their approach to the games, you know, the chat behind the stumps, all that kind of stuff? Were you guys briefed about, you know, watching out for that kind of thing?
No, definitely not. The thing is, the thing about the, I guess, the coverage as well with Seven, you know, commercial TV can be a bit, they can be a bit of chest beating and stuff like that. I've not experienced that at all. Like, basically the brief and what everyone, I don't really see any big egos, you know, there are big names, obviously, with some of the former players, but it's not like that. It hasn't been like that at all, and everyone's just wanted the cricket to just speak for itself, and, you know, test cricket is what it is, and it's, you know, it's its own oh, it's brilliant, isn't it? So you just let it go. And in terms of looking out for stuff, no, there's nothing like that. Everyone's just go in, do your bit, don't be over the top, and just enjoy and let sort of the cricket speak for itself. Nothing like that.
Yeah. Mel, at the risk of this sounding like, you know, Channel 7 cross-promotion between colleagues, like, have you, just on that note, have you guys received briefs around wanting to return cricket back to its kind of broadcasting roots? Because, you know, at Channel, we're happy to say it, we know you're too wise not to say it, but at Channel 9, it just became a massive jock fest. Whereas Channel 7 have kind of approached it as having proper sportscasters covering it ball by ball, and some really quite like sober analysis with guys like Gideon and Pete Lawler and Trent Copeland doing data analysis that kind of like raise the estimation of Australian, you know, consumer intelligence. Like, are you guys, like, is that a deliberate thing from you guys? You know, we noted earlier that Fox are just talking about Warney double dipping his sausage rolls. Is that the great differentiator between both networks?
No, listen, everybody doesn't. Sausage roll, so we're not high class or high risk. Okay,
so we're just putting it on primetime television.
So Dave Barham, who Seven brought over, he was my boss. He was the head of sport at Ten, and I've never known anyone like him in terms of he's a very, very good human being for a start. But he just doesn't see like a gender. He doesn't see a difference. He doesn't look at you and think you're female, so let's do this, or you're male, let's do this. And under him, when we did the Big Bash and I guess all different sports coverage, the Winter Olympics, things like that, I'm going back a few years, he'd say to us, just keep being yourselves. I've got you guys, you know, I just want you to be your personality. Don't worry about anything else. And you know, no egos and things like that. And you just tend to put like just a good bunch of people together that got along, and you know, there was no issues. So he went over to Sam and largely put together the team that he did. And so as soon as I knew he was there, I knew it was going to be something really special. And then Chris Jones, he's basically kind of taken over things as well. Between them, they came up with these ideas and put the team together and put, you know, like you say, Gideon Hague and stuff. Just the ideas that came across and the feel that they wanted was, I don't know, I know it's different, and I know that I got excited when I heard the kind of ideas. And they're very open. I mentioned Ange before, another producer. They're very, very open to ideas and changing things and going, oh, that worked, well, that didn't work, how about we do this? And, you know, someone might have an idea, can we try this? And that's including the Big Bash as well. And they go, yeah, fine, great, you know. And so that you don't always find that, but that's something that I've found, you know, everyone's really happy working in that kind of environment, you know, a different approach. And as you say, Tim Lane, I know that they've approached Tim Lane and said, listen, I think you can do this. And I think, you know, I think Tim was not necessarily, or maybe he was a bit hesitant at first. Not that he didn't want to do it, but I think it was, can I do this? You know, TV, different thing, Channel 7. And, you know, he's loved every minute. We've loved having him on board and having Pete and Gideon come in and just, they've got license, haven't they, to just, you know, tee off if they want to. And I've told them, I think yesterday Pete was a little bit positive about something. He started positively and I said, do you have a fever? Because they can come in and just go, oh, this is bad. But, you know, they don't do that. But it's just good fun where they can say things that some of the commentators can't as well. So we're trying to have everything covered in that regard. And I realise this is the world's longest answer, and I do apologise for that, but I was trying to give some context, starting with Dave Barham, and this is just where the ideas come from. And I apologise for all of that. You've fallen asleep.
No, we haven't fallen asleep at all. I mean, the only missing piece is obviously getting the Grey Cricketer on the broadcast. But that aside, I agree. I think Channel 7 has...
Okay, thinly veiled hint.
A little bit veiled.
Not that we're colleagues, but Channel 7 colleagues. You probably don't know we have a show on Channel 7, Mel. Yeah. I mean, you've always been coy, but we actually do have a show on Channel 7.
I've been made aware. don't think the bowlologist is happy about it, just quietly.
Oh, no,
so, you know, have you had him on?
Yes.
Yeah.
He actually came into the room once. He wasn't a guest. He just walked in.
Yeah.
Why do Hodge and Fleming hate us? Because we're just normal.
It's because we weren't as good at cricket.
We weren't as good as cricket.
He plays me test matches.
Yeah.
No, it's just, you know, it's just direct competition. Yeah. Just
direct,
authority.
Direct. Seeking digital revenues, both of us.
Yeah.
Do you know, isn't that funny? So we've just identified the lack of rivalry, true rivalry between Fox and Seven commentators and broadcast teams, but it's... you guys and Flem and Hodgie. There's a real problem. You're supposed to be on the same team.
Oh, really? That's
interesting. I think you got to get them on.
Yeah.
And there's only enough market share for one obscure niche satirical comedy trio.
Podcast numbers. I know it's very competitive out there, you know?
Mm, yeah, I think they probably have a quarter of ours. Anyway, g'day, Hodgie, if you're listening, because I know you listen to all of it. Anyway, if this is not enough of an... an insider conversation that people are listening to, I think that should pretty much wrap us up. Mel, thank you so much for the insights into Seven. truly, and especially we're going right inside it now with how much Hodge and Fleming hate us. But
I didn't say that for the record.
Don't worry, we've been told that five other times by them face to face. But
I'm okay if you edit it to make it sound like I said that. That's fine.
I know, that's fine. But no, thank you for joining the cast at short notice, Mel, and we'll catch you out throughout the summer.
It's been a pleasure. Good luck, and we'll get you on Seven somehow. We'll do it, right? Right? Anyone?
Right? Anyone?
Okay.
Cool.
Boys, it's budgie smuggler time, and I guess we have been talking a little bit about the problems Australian cricket has with orthodoxy. It wrestles with orthodoxy so much. You've got to play straight. You've got to use the ball machine. It's all elbow up. But then we try and be unorthodox sometimes and sort of appoint two vice captains out of nowhere or people who don't actually score runs into the side. Mm. We are trying to endorse the change in Australia from orthodoxy to unorthodoxy, and that's why we want to change from board shorts to budgie smugglers. We want to customise. Mm. We want to go bespoke. I get very animated and gesticulating wildly to Dave as I say this.
There's nothing more a great cricket than an over-the-knee boardie.
Mm.
And, you know, and things need to change, you know, in swimwear for Australia, you know, and society in general. So we're talking about custom budgies. So I'm just on the Budgie Smugglers website right now, lads, budgiesmuggler.com.au. It's in a private tab, obviously, just in case. You know. And you can do a custom design request. You fill out your details there. You drop in a logo. It's very simple. It's just in a tab there, design your own budgies. And that's what we're all about today, designing our own shit.
Yep. And what's also good, lads, is I believe that they produce all their smugglers onshore. You know, and I think that that's really important in this day and age of, you know, jobs for Australians and everything that kind of Trump's going on about. Not wanting to connotate Trump with budgie smugglers. Just want to be really, really clear about that. These are separate things.
Well, this is about, you know, we live in an on-demand society and you can customise your own smugglers. There is an offer this week, actually, so we can actually sound like a real podcast. If you quote the grade cricketer when purchasing your budgie smugglers, you'll get your design and setup done for free for any orders of 11 pairs or more.
Okay. Is that in store? Do you just go in there and just walk around the store saying, the grade cricketer, just walk around aimlessly, or is that just online?
No, you don't just like quote like some of our best hits, like just go in there and quote a tweet that we did about champing or chopping. Yeah. No, or actually use the words the grade cricketer.
Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Carry on.
I think
so it doesn't because I say 11 pairs or more, obviously that's a play on, you know, cricket teams, etc. But it doesn't have to be for a cricket team, it could be for a Bucks party, whatever. The turnaround to get your smugglers back is about 3 to 4 weeks. That offer lasts until Australia Day as well. So custom smugglers, 11 pairs or more, get your design and set up for free. That's budgiesmuggler.com.au, custom smugglers for a bespoke society.
Mm.
Well, look, it doesn't get much more prodigal than this bloke. He played Australian under-19s for what seemed like 1,000 years. He was the youngest to represent New South Wales at List A level. He's played 87 first-class matches. There'll be many more. Approaching 5,000 runs, highest of 265, 8 tons, 20 50s, 106 wickets with a best of 5 for 17. He's represented his country 26 times, making his test debut at Chennai in 2013. He hit 68 in a partnership of 151 with Michael Clarke, then made 81 not out in the second innings, batting at 7, where the next top score was 32, which would have permitted him to feel great smug satisfaction in the change rooms afterwards. He's a St George grade at club level, the undoubted prodigy of our age group, with tales of this young Portuguese maestro wafting through the junior ranks. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome Moses Henriquez to the Grey Cricketer podcast. Moses, hello.
Hello, how are you going? That was a pretty impressive intro. Thanks, lad.
No, you're very welcome. Moses, let's start the way we always start, talking about grade cricket. You know, we all have specific experience of you in grade cricket. You've just been absolutely dominant at all costs and all times. What's your relationship to it?
I guess having played from a relatively young age, and coming in, and when I came in to play for St George, I had a lot of those, I guess, those elder statesmen that, you know, I sort of revered and looked up to, you know, the state players, as you guys call them. You know, I remember playing with like Nathan Pillen, and Nathan Catalano was playing a bit of second 11 at the time, and I just thought these guys were like, you know, like demigods basically. But you know, and I just tried to do everything I could to impress them. And you know, as you get a bit older, you realise that, you know, no one actually really cares. So you know, but at the same time, you know, it's the foundation of obviously New South Wales cricket, and then Australian cricket with how many people come out of it. But I still play for St George, the same club that I've played for basically since, you know, in the under-10s. And, I still really enjoy going back there. The faces have changed, but the stories have pretty much stayed the same.
And that's great cricket in a nutshell. Moses, I mean, you were the ultimate prodigy, as we said earlier in the intro, the player of promise coming through the ranks. And I remember growing up, your name was, you know, whispered in hushed tones about this fast-balling all-rounder who was, you know, going to take the world by storm. What was it like coming into grade cricket and playing amongst adult men with all this kind of expectation and hype around yourself?
It was a strange one. I mean, I took 10 for in like my fourth game, so I thought I was pretty good. And I was like, is this what first grade cricket's about? Pretty easy, but I came back to earth pretty quickly. You know, I had my second or third year, definitely struggled a bit more with the ball. It wasn't probably until I was like 20 or 21 that I actually started to score some runs and take some wickets quite consistently. So whilst the first year was, you know, I was pretty lucky with the ball, but you know, I didn't really get going definitely until I was sort of, you know, 19, 20, and a bit later on. But yeah, it was it was strange. I think when you're that young, you don't really you play like, I was so sort of just loving cricket and enjoying it that I didn't worry about the expectation. That probably didn't set in until much later on, when I probably realised that, I started to feel that I should have done a lot more than I actually had.
Totally, mate. I'm just noting what you said earlier around wanting to impress second 11 demigods in grade cricket, like many of us did coming into the ranks. Like, now that you've sort of spanned a few generations as a grade player of promise, and now obviously the elder statesman, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Do you notice younger players doing the same to you, you know, and do they try and impress you in the same ways you tried to impress, you know, Nathan Pillen and Nathan Catalano?
I don't really notice
lower graders.
I don't notice that they try to impress, but I definitely feel at times, especially in more recent years, as I've probably gotten a little bit, you know, that age divide starts to become a little bit more evident, that they may be a little bit more intimidated rather than, and they've got nothing to be intimidated about. So I do try and break down those barriers as quick as possible. You know, and ask them about, you know, what they do on their weekends, and, you know, if they've got any interesting late night stories for me and that sort of stuff, and try and, you know, get down on their level and make them feel comfortable knowing that I'm not there to cast judgment.
I was going to say, actually, when you were saying, you know, you try and help them out and break down barriers, that maybe there's been a generational change, because I don't remember that.
No.
As a junior, like, you know, if someone was intimidating, they'd exploit that to their full advantage. But then you said you ask about late night stories, and then I thought, oh, no, it's just the same.
Yeah. And then I laugh at how bad their stories are.
So nothing has changed.
Yeah. Okay.
That's very good.
Yeah, that's right.
Just going back chronologically, which is obviously a good interviewing technique, back to kind of your formative years, more formative years. You're actually, obviously we mentioned that you've got Portuguese heritage in the introduction. A lot of grade cricketers are usually have overbearing, you know, white Anglo fathers who are vicariously trying to live their failed dreams through their sons. You know, but having Portuguese parents who presumably didn't know a lot about cricket, I don't know, what was your relationship there growing up with, you know, your parents in respect to them coming to games and kind of being there at your games and so on?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. My old man, obviously pretty decent soccer player or football player, back home in on the island of Madeira in Portugal. And, you know, I played soccer for a couple of years, and I just remember, like, him shouting from the sidelines if I'd, like, been hacked or if I didn't, you know, if I didn't score three goals in the game or something like that. And I was like, you know what, I just can't handle this. So I stopped playing straight away. And to be fair, my passion was always cricket anyway. So in the backyard, I kicked the ball around with Dad a little bit, but I was, you know, for the other 5 hours of the afternoon, I was throwing a ball against the wall and hitting it and going to chase it. So I sort of, I bat, bowled and fielded all on my own because my dad refused to indulge in this Australian sport called cricket. So, you know, I was sort of, but that was always a passion of mine. And he was like, you know, after a couple of years and once he gave up the hope of me being a football player, or soccer player, sorry, you know, he started to carry on like he'd played cricket for Australia anyway. So, it was pretty transferable, you know. I do remember one time I got run out on 99 in junior cricket, and he asked me why I played that shot. Why did you? I wasn't on strike though. That's when I knew his cricket prowess had no credentials. So that's when you
emancipated yourself.
Yeah, I think that's good.
I mean, you've obviously, you know, you played Shield cricket at a time when it would have been regarded as an extremely strong competition. Now there's a lot of conversation about, you know, the merits of it as a producer of Australian cricketers. What's your take on that? You know, we're trying to work out how to pick the best Australian side and what the actual secret door knock is to get into the Australian side. You know, how are you finding Shield cricket now in terms of its like credibility on how good the players are versus how it was when you came into play?
Look, it is a strange one because like club cricket, when you first come into play, you're inexperienced and, you know, you're learning and you don't really know that much about the game, and you do put everyone that you play with up on a pedestal or that you play against up on a pedestal as well. And the same thing happens in Shield cricket. So when you first come in, you know, I thought it was, you know, all these amazing things, but then you kind of realise with time that it's not really the quality that gets worse. It's just that you as a player improve and become more experienced. And I do believe that, you know, maybe in club cricket to a degree because of the demands on, you know, the families and you know, the guys that used to play in their later 20s and early 30s, and because of how much we play on Saturday and Sunday now in club cricket, they might call it quits a bit earlier than what they used to. But, you know, I definitely feel in Shield cricket that whilst the, you know, there aren't guys averaging 50, but I dare say there's probably a lot more bowlers averaging less than 30 going around in Shield cricket than there were 15 years ago. And I think it's just the nature of the wickets that we play on. You know, they're all result wickets now. And there's sort of, you know, whilst we don't have those guys coming out, you know, in the press, everyone's saying, you know, we don't have these guys averaging 50 like we used to, but, you know, we've got bowlers coming out of our backsides averaging, you know, 25, 26 and less. You know, I could almost peel off 10 bowlers averaging less than that in first-class cricket. So you're sort of robbing Peter to give to Paul. And if it was the opposite, you know, if you've got all these flat wickets, then you think your batter abundant and you've got no bowlers. So, you know, it's sort of a... It's kind of the environment we've sort of come up in. And that's not to make an excuse for the batters. Like, obviously, being an all-rounder, I've got my foot in both camps, but, you know, I do feel that the wickets probably, definitely, even from when I first started playing, the wickets definitely have a little bit more spice in them. You know, I hear stories from the 90s and the early 2000s that Belrive was just, you know, a run paradise, basically. You just turn up and, you know, Michael Bevan would score 200 there or something like that. But now it's like a team struggles to score 200 there across both innings. So, you know, I think the nature of the wickets and so on just change, and as will the batters' averages or the bowlers' averages as well.
Just on that, Moses, I mean, like, there's been obviously a lot of chat about, you know, the state of the wickets around the country. Is this a thing that you guys are noticing as well, and, you know, on the Shield circuit, you know, just how flat Melbourne and Sydney are particularly? Is that a conversation you guys have as well?
Look, definitely those two wickets are the most benign in state cricket in terms of, you know, they're probably where we're in the first innings at the SCG anyway. It's where you really want to cash in, and it's the same at the MCG. But the, you know, the other four wickets around the country, they're hard work. You know, Adelaide now, again, another wicket that used to just be a, you know, like, you used to go to Adelaide and just hope that you're batting in the top three or four because of how good the wicket was. Where now it's, you know, you're hoping you're batting nine, so that the ball hard when you get in there because there's 10 mils of grass on the thing. So it's just a different dynamic. But those two wickets definitely, you know, I know we've struggled to get some results at the SCG, and, you know, it's the same story at the MCG. But at the same time, they also create hardened bowlers. You know, that the Victorian bowling attack, because they've had to bowl on flat wickets and learn how to take, you know, wickets on a wicket that basically offers nothing. You know, guys like Scott Boland, Chris Tremaine, you know, it actually makes them a lot better bowlers. So, just like batters who might average high 30s on green wickets, you know, it makes them much better batters as well. So, you know, when the time comes for them to go elsewhere, you know, they can really cash in because they've done all the work on, you know, harder wickets.
Sure, I mean, just going back to your career as well, I mean, you've played four tests now, 11 ODIs and 11 T20s. Do you feel a bit aggrieved that you haven't been, you know, you haven't played more for Australia, or even seem to be sort of in the conversation, particularly with a test match, you know, in the test match circuit? But, you know, you're obviously going to the IPL as well this year. You know, you've had a fantastic domestic career and you've never let Australia down, certainly. Do you feel sort of a little bit surprised or aggrieved or whatever the right word is that you haven't, you know, sort of played more for Australia?
It's a strange one because when I've played ODI cricket, I've probably not quite done as well as I would have liked. But at the same time, I think I played too much cricket for Australia when I didn't believe I should have been playing, and that's probably affected, you know, my output in those games. Where now I kind of feel like if I was thrown in there, I'd be more than good enough. But it takes a little while for you to genuinely believe that you belong at a certain level. And, you know, I remember getting picked for my first T20 and my... I was in first-class cricket. I hadn't really done the business, so I kind of felt like a bit of an imposter. You know, and I got picked on potential a little bit. I ended up playing sort of five or six games and didn't do that well, probably as a product of not actually doing that well at the level below either. You know, and then it ends up sort of, you know, you get a little bit of scarring thinking that, oh shit, you know, I'm not good enough or whatever it might be. Not that I never thought that consciously, but I think subconsciously maybe I did. But definitely in the last 5 years, I would have loved to play for Australia more. I'd love to be able to manipulate my career statistics and just take out the first 4 or 5 years of, you know, my batting in first class cricket and one day cricket and so on, and just, you know, throw out my last 5 or 6 years, because, you know, I think what I did when I was sort of 18, 19, 20, 21 shouldn't be held against someone for how they're batting now. or how they're bowling now, if that makes sense. So, you know, I just, whilst my batting average in Shield cricket is probably only 36 or 37, the first 3 or 4 years, it would have been less than 20. Mm. So it's sort of, it's taken a while even just to get to where it is now, and hopefully it keeps going in the right direction. But, you know, at the same time, I do certainly feel like, you know, that I would love to play more cricket for Australia now, and that I do feel ready to play if thrown the opportunity. And I know it's, you know, another step up, and not everyone's made for that level as well, but, you know, I'm definitely a lot more confident in myself to play at that level now than what I was probably when I was initially picked as a sort of 21-year-old, 22-year-old. You know, and I think that to get that belief, it does take experience, and it does take sort of knowing that you've done the business at the level below as well.
Well said, mate. One more before we head into the throwdowns component. So, Moses, back in November, you were gracious and courageous enough to give the public a glimpse into your experience with mental illness, and firstly, congrats on sharing that story. Anyone listening to this show should read Gideon's piece on it in The Australian and watch the 7:30 report piece on it as well. Don't want to kind of go back into it because it's covered really well in both of those pieces. I suppose my question to you, mate, is, you know, what prompted you coming out to do that, and how much, you know, how much do you believe that other cricketers might be experiencing mental illness issues as well? Do you think it might even be more than other sports, as has been reported in the past?
Yeah, look, I definitely feel it is very common in cricket. To what state and what how much people suffer is probably like a case by case. I think, you know, maybe not to say that it's not prevalent in other sports, because I'm sure it is, but I think just because of how time-consuming our game is and how statistically based it is, it's sort of, you know, it is, whilst it's a team sport, it's almost an individual sport at the same time. And it can be lonely at times, which is quite, you know, but I can only, you know, I can only imagine the comparisons to, you know, tennis and golf and swimming and those types of sports, especially like when you've got no teammates around to lean on. But I guess, you know, I think it is very prevalent in cricket. You know, I definitely think there's a lot more people that suffer in silence, or, you know, that suffer and don't come out and speak publicly about it, or whatever it might be. And I don't think you need to, but, you know, each to their own, as I said. But I guess what prompted me was, you know, I was sort of being on the board of a charity and a couple of different things. I wanted to do everything I could to make sure that I could, you know, not only raise as much money, but raise as much awareness as possible for, and like, I guess, for those that are suffering that didn't have the facilities or the resources around them that I did. So, you know, I mean, it's never easy going through something like that. But I think for me, and any professional athlete that goes through it, that's part of a professional team, usually these days there's mountains of resources to call upon, and just so much help there, you've just got to want it. And I guess it's just making sure, or trying to break down the gap between what was available for me as a professional cricketer to recover from depression, in comparison to what's available to someone who doesn't have the finances, or who doesn't have that support, or the support of their family and friends, or an employer that's going to support them. So it's kind of trying to break down the gap of what's available to, you know, to me and to, I guess, you know, someone less fortunate. So that was probably the main reason as to why I spoke publicly, because it did sort of, I remember waking up a couple of mornings at my lowest and thinking, like, I've literally got everything I need, but still not happy. Mm. Imagine if I didn't have, imagine I, you know, didn't have everything I need. Mm. How, like, how unhappy would I be then, if that made sense? And I, like, it sort of, like, down to, like, it just made me sort of realise that people who suffer, who might not have families, who might be, you know, who, like, families, supportive families, and might not have supportive friends and workers. Like, it's just a completely different game. And just, I guess, trying to raise money and awareness and funds so that, you know, that at least there's, you know, maybe we can offer some sort of help in some way to someone who can't afford to pay for it, I guess.
Once again, you know, well said, and commend both of those pieces to anybody listening. They really are, you know, really insightful stories, and I think you've done a great job there. Just to be completely jarring and unjournalistic, we're going to move to the throwdown section. with that earnestness done, so let me kick off, Moses, and again, thanks for sharing what you did just there before, but you've achieved much through cricket and beyond, representing your country in all three formats, skippering your country and state, record-breaking appearances for your state, hundreds and fifers galore. You're on the board of the Chapel Foundation, does great work for youth homelessness. Your Twitter page is a shower of gratitude and praise for your teammates and a strange fascination with Tesla. With all that in mind, what do you consider your greatest achievement, and why is it your high school naming at sports ground Moses on Rick's Field?
Sorry?
I was scrolling through your Wikipedia page and I just noticed a picture on it. I hope you curated it yourself, but there's a picture of Endeavour Sports High naming its number one field Moses Enriquez Field.
I don't think that's the number one field there, but I think it's like the third field, and it doesn't ever get mowed either, but I don't think I ever said it was my greatest achievement. Were they just... Where was that?
I actually inserted that with poetic license.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I was like, geez, I've been stitched up on Wikipedia.
Being named after a number two field is a much greater acclaim than number one. A lot of interesting things happen on number two fields. Moses, you were involved in the Homework Gate series. Are you glad that over time the truth finally emerged and that everyone finally learned that Mickey Arthur was the root of all evil?
No.
Perfectly answered.
Moses, in a 2013 CATV production entitled Starkey Stories or something, Mitch roams an Indian hotel providing light insight into the goings-on with players. As he walks down a corridor, he bellows, "Moises," before entering your room to a scene that has caused much conjecture on sites like Reddit, cricketbants.com and Triple M's hilarious web content. As Mitch walks in, the camera shows you sitting upright on your bed, blankets covering your legs and waist, and you, upon seeing Mitch and the cameraman, gently but swiftly shutting your laptop. When asked what you were doing, you replied, listening to some Spotify and chilling out. My question is, how good is Kid Cudi, especially sitting on your bed with no headphones and a blanket covering your waist?
Well, usually what happens when you listen to music on your own in a room, you don't need headphones because there's no one else. And I don't know about you, Blake, but when you're going out at hammer and tong, you don't leave your hotel door wide open when you know a camera crew is about to turn up.
And hiding in plain sight.
And as much as, you know, as much as I love playing cricket for Australia, like, getting up in my training shirt is probably not my number one ad hire when I'm about to, you know, I guess relieve some tension.
Can you confirm that you were actually just watching highlights of Damien Martin's cover drive circa 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. You know what? It was just a bad. It was a bad look when you. I guess when you're in a hotel room, you don't have a desk, or you know, you've only got your bed. They're like, I try and make it look natural when the cameras come in, like we've just interrupted something.
Yeah.
You know, I probably should have been above the sheets.
Yeah.
I look back and go, well, you know, Spotify, like, I actually was listening to Spotify, but at the same time, like, geez, it looks bad.
Because you're kind of like looking at the laptop, and you don't look at a laptop with Spotify on, you know what I mean? Because listening is an audible kind of thing. But anyway,
it's a great UX. Yeah. And I can't wait for season two of Starkey's Stories.
Yeah.
How good to see ATV. Great production work they do there. Moses, a quick one here. Your career has taken you a range of global locations, some idyllic, others heady. What is more dangerous and exhausting, playing in the heat and with loose security conditions of a third world country, or beers with Stephen O'Keefe?
Definitely the latter.
Dangerous and exhausting.
Yeah. I think he's, whilst, you know, after a couple, he might get a little verbal, but he's one of the most misunderstood guys going around. You know, I think he's at the crux of it. He's got a really good heart. He's someone that, you know, he cops it. He's been fine. He's been penalised enough a lot, but I know, you know, if you're walking down the street and, you know, you're a 60-year-old lady with carrying some shopping bags and you look like you're struggling, he would generally pull his car over, you know, and help you get to where you need to go. He's just so aware of what's going on around him, you know, when, I guess, 99% of the time. And he's extremely helpful and kind and caring to those less fortunate, which you can't say a lot about a lot of elite cricketers or elite sportsmen. And, you know, he doesn't, you know, there's no ego to him. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't think he's better than the average, like, you know, your normal sort of human being or anything like that. He's, you know, he's well aware that everyone's equal. He just, you know, obviously he's not afraid to tell people what he thinks, which is fine. Some people don't like hearing what people think of him. So, but he's, you know, he's actually very much misunderstood, I feel. And definitely, you know, if you're living in a community with Steve in it, and you know you're lucky enough to call him a friend, you're pretty well off.
Oh, that's beautiful. Moses, we understand that Sydney is a hotbed of haves and have-nots, of entitled private school products like Ed Cowan versus Salt of the Earth, the state school folk, of those with property to negatively gear and those struggling to make rent, of the affluent East and the grinding West. So with that in mind, within New South Wales cricket ranks, how much of a status symbol is it to ply your BBL trade with the glitzy East-based Sydney Sixers as opposed to the Homebush-based Thunder?
I mean, that was the basis of my decision.
Socioeconomic.
Yeah.
That's right. Like, someone who, you know, I was state school based. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I was raised off welfare. So I was kind of like, this is my opportunity to step into Ed Cowan land.
Upwardly mobile, yeah. Aspirational. It's beautiful stuff. I've got a slightly long-winded and indulgent one here, Moses. So one of the greatest moments of my junior career was the time I beat an unbeaten 130-odd for Gordon against St George in Green Shield circa 2001. You were playing in this team, if I recall. you were definitely playing in this game. I think you hit 70-odd, if I recall correctly. Anyway, in the final stages of this match, I made a tactical bowling change error and was forced to bowl a part-timer who was promptly bombed for consecutive sixes in the last over by St George's number 11 to win the game in the final over. My question really is, in the intervening years, how many times have you thought about that match? And secondly, did you ever imagine that David Edwards, this young centurion, would later go on to become one-third of a vaguely popular satirical cricket comedy trio? And the answer, as always, is I don't remember him or this ever happening.
I actually do remember that happening.
Oh, no.
I do remember the innings vividly, just because I remember never ever seeing that guy again after that 100.
Where did that young centurion go?
Yeah. I was like, that guy's actually a pretty good cricketer. Where did he fall off to? So, but it's great to know that you've become one-third of this great trio.
I remember that Steve Rixon, Daniel Rixon's father, was actually at that ground that day, and he, according to one of my teammates, slept through my entire innings. And he was the New South Wales coach at the time, so sliding doors, could have played state cricket.
But instead,
yeah, if I recall correctly, you're using a gun more.
Oh, that's unbelievable, almost autistic memory, and I'm yeah. saving this as a soundbite.
Yeah. So, Moses, what actually happened in that game was, so I was also playing in that game, and what happened was Dave's peeled off 150 or something against you, but he never actually faced you. I had to face him over bumpers against you, whilst Edo's at the other end was just like peeling off this off spinner. I haven't slept since you bumped me six times in an over, in under 16 fixture.
And you're tired.
Yeah, I think I actually bowled faster when I was 14 than I do now.
Yeah.
So, through a lot of injuries and so on, like I think the peak of my my bowling speed was when I was about 16 and a half.
Sorry, I'm still shaken by the fact that you remember the brand of bat that I was using. Yeah.
But, absolutely, I remember the knock vividly.
Yeah. Although you sledged him wildly before that, we're not going to hear the end of the fact that you remember his bat, so thanks for saying that.
Yep.
Moses, and more broadly, thanks for being such a great guest. That's one of our favourites, I'm pretty sure I can say that hand on heart already. So, mate, really appreciate your time and enduring everything that happened just then. wishing you all the best for the remainder of the season, and I think you're better than Mitch Marsh, and he got a good go. So let's see you over at the Ashes. If we do live shows, maybe you can be a guest.
That'd be great. Thanks, lad.
Amazing to have Mel McLaughlin and Moses Enriquez on the same show. All right, hashtag ICGC coming up in just a moment's time. Before we get into that, the live shows, well, we finished the India League. We've been to Adelaide, we've been to Perth, we've been to Melbourne. We did two shows in Sydney. We had Trent Copeland for the second live show in Sydney. Ed wasn't available, but they've been going well. Boys, have you been enjoying them?
Very much so, especially the opportunity to bring people like my wife and mother-in-law and father along to see that it's not just one-third random internet account jokes. We're real people in the flesh and people come and see us. That's just my personal enjoyment of it.
Edos?
I've had a whale of a time, mate. I mean, I probably have drunk more in the last 3 weeks than I have in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
But that's what you do when you're a celebrity and people buy VIP tickets and they want to rub shoulders with you. And they're paying that extra $20 to do that. So you give them the privilege of 3 seconds of your time.
We were talking this morning. Probably the best thing we've done. I think the most favourite thing we've done so far. Anyway, we've got a couple of shows left, Brisbane and Canberra, coming into your cities for the Sri Lankan leg of the tour. This year, the Brisbane test is a day-night test. So we couldn't do it on the night of the test because people were going to be at the game. So we thought, well, we'll go the night before. So January 23, we're going to be in Brisbane. That's a Wednesday night, I'm fairly certain. We're going to be doing our live show in Brisbane. And then on the 1st of February, we are in Canberra for the final show.
At the ANU Big Band Room.
The Big Band Room.
Conjures up great imagery, doesn't it?
Does.
Big swing bands.
Two things. First of all, thank you so much to everyone who came. Sold out Adelaide, sold out Melbourne, sold out Sydney, Perth.
Didn't sell out Perth?
Not so much. Long way to go.
It's so good.
We'll take a different marketing strategy next time, I think.
We didn't have any Gina Reinhart money behind us, so we couldn't sell out Perth. But anyway, thank you so much for those who came to be part of those nights. They're awesome nights for those who are interested in coming into Brisbane and Canberra. Tickets are available. Go onto the Facebook page. Just type it. Search it yourself. If you can listen to this podcast, you can find our tickets. You know how it works. Anyway, bring a mate, come along. They're great nights. They're great fun.
If you ask us how to find it, you can't come.
that's the rule. That's the rule. All right, okay. It's a longer episode, I'm fairly certain already, so we'll just do a couple of hashtag RCGCs. Thanks for your questions who have written, as many written in. Already had loads to talk about. We're just going to do two to wrap up the show. Jordan Donald says, my dad has been listening to every podcast since I told him how good TGC is. I believe that was my worst mistake. Since then, every chance my dad has had to chant me and realistically embarrassed me in our team in Newcastle City and Suburban Cricket Association where we play in the competition. For example, he's man-catted me. He likes to bring up my 1.06 average, but barely talks about my bowling average of 20. And the worst one was bringing a princess birthday cake for my birthday in front of the team. Is there any way I can get back from this? I need ideas to get back on top. Interesting question, Jordan. Who wants to take on this one? How does he get back at his dad?
I'm just looking at Dave here because there's so many things in my head. First things first. If you average 1.06 with the bat, that is woefully low.
That is woefully low.
I mean, you'd have six as well because that implies there've been lots of innings. It's not just like I average one and you had like you know. Yeah, a couple of knocks.
Not even a nick through second slip for four, which would then counterbalance three ducks. You'd have a higher average with that.
Like batting
1.06.
Batting is hard, but it's not that hard. Like it's not 1.06 hard.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that he likes to bring up your 1.06 average because it's a genuine talking point.
Yes.
But he must be a good father for you to kind of very kind of I guess like graciously tell this story about him when he's giving you birthday cakes that say princess on it.
And knowing that he is a keen listener of this podcast.
Yeah.
How's he man-catted him? He hasn't said that if they play together. They can't play together if he's man-catted. They must play against each other. But then he's brought a princess birth. There's a lot going on.
Maybe it means it metaphorically.
He's metaphorically man-catted.
Yeah, that's right.
Metaphorically.
Because man-catting is a cuckolding. It's basically cuckolding.
Right, okay.
So he's asked for any ideas on how to get back on top. Do we have any ideas for him?
Well, he's asked us for ideas and we've brought up his 1.06 batting average relentlessly and discussed how bad that actually is. So there's no help for Jordan.
Way back for Jordan.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. So he should quit cricket.
Okay, he should quit cricket. As ever, the answer, quit cricket. All right. How about this one, lads? Matthew Hearn writes in, he says, hashtag AskTD. So a few years ago, I was playing some park cricket and the captain asked me to roll the arm over. I hadn't bowled in 5 years due to shoulder surgery, so fair to say they came out a bit stiff. The third ball I bowled got hit back over my head onto the road for the biggest six I've ever seen. As I turned around to walk back to my mark, the non-striker looked me straight in the eyes and said as loud as he could, "That was an absolute meat pie. What do I do? Can I ever recover from this?"
That's one of the most
village statements ever. So you can easily come back from that because that is fucking lowbrow.
Yeah. So the non-striker said that's an absolute, he's capitalized absolute, an absolute meat pie.
I mean, firstly, like I've heard meat pie shortened to just pie as a terrible delivery. So even like the extension of what is really like shorthand, that's poor to start with. I'm just trying to go through this slowly.
Okay.
So it's a non-striker who's probably got like shirt hanging out of his of his pants. He's probably wearing black sneakers and he's probably thought, oh, what's a funny word for a bad ball? And he's looked at the ball and gone, that's a meat pie. That
should work. I like that both questions that we've fielded today have been, how can I get back from this?
Yeah, exactly,
essentially the same ending to each question.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
You can never get back from it.
And you never will.
The best thing I think that the non-striker could have said, like what he could have said something way worse than that.
Yeah.
Just like, is everything okay at home?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
Have you never done this before? Is this your first game?
I think I saw your dad behind the sight screen.
That's a much better way of going about sledging, isn't it? Rather than the very like prosaic kind of accurate description of what happened. You know, that was a bad ball. Mm. I mean, that's kind of really elementary level sledging. It's much better to get into issues of the mind.
So Matthew, yes, you can get back from this. Actually, someone else asked, like, remember how we used to do the escape goats? We did that for a while. Then I just forgot to chase it up. And then someone asked, have people stop writing in the scapegoat stories because like you can never escape it.
Yeah.
And that's basically the crux of this. Can I ever recover from this? Well, no, you can't. But at the same time, you never escape. All right.
Sounded like one of those post-political ads. Brought to you by the AFL.
Thank you to Moses Enriquez to coming on the show. Thank you, Mel McLaughlin, for coming on the show. Thank you, Dave Edwards, for coming on the show. Sam Perry. Thank you to our producer, Toby Shane, who I should shout out, has just had a daughter. Congratulations,
Welcome
Shano.
To the club.
And thank you very much for all the work that you've done for us, Shano, over the years. My name's Ian Higgins, signing off. We'll see you next week.